You're listening to the Physio Matters podcast in association with Choose Health, and this is session 16. Welcome back to the Physio Matters podcast with me, Jack Chu. Session 15 with Heather Watson has gone down a storm, and we even released a soundbite of Heather's brilliant promotion of how physios are best suited to resolving work-related problems. Tune into our YouTube page for that. Remember, she's available for mentoring, advice and guidance through Choose Health, as are all of our associated therapists in the network. This month's episode features a chat I had with Greg Lehman, a physio, chiro, MSc biomechanist and all-round internet personality from Toronto, Canada. Back in March, I did what many therapists do and attended a course that I suspected would sit well with my philosophy. The workshop format completely exceeded my already high expectations, and I was then fortunate enough to catch Greg for a beer and a chat at a local bar that evening. With it being a public recording, you'll have to forgive a little background noise and the editing points where strangers approached us for autographs. But by way of an apology from us, links to more Physio Matters broadcasts in association with iFompt 2016 are featured at the end of the show, including a great interview with Dr. Jeremy Lewis, which very much complements this one. But first to Brighton with Greg Lehman. Hi, Greg. Would you like to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Oh, great. I'm Greg Lehman. I'm a physiotherapist and chiropractor from Toronto, Canada.
It'd be really interesting for you to tell the listeners a little bit about your history. Far from standard, is it fair for me to say?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it was standard. I'm just inefficient. You know, it was 12 years of university. If you ever want advice on how to go to school, talk to me because I can tell you what not to do. That's what I'm going to say. So I had a four-year undergrad in kinesiology. It's sort of sports sciences. And I knew I really liked biomechanics and exercise physiology. And I lucked out and got a pretty good a scholarship because one of my mentors pretty much wrote the grant application for me.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I was like, I'm not doing cardiac physiology. He's like, who cares? Just take this and you can do it. It's an NSERC. It's a National Science Engineering Research Council. So you can do whatever you want. And by then I knew I wanted to work with Stu McGill at Waterloo. And I was able to go to Waterloo for my master's and study spine biomechanics with Stu, who's amazing, as everyone knows. And he lets you argue with him and debate with him. And that really started my career of, like, thinking critically.
What sort of time frame we're talking for that?
That was 1996. So I've been a bit of a jerk for a long time, my own life would say, and asking the same questions and doubts and challenging everything that I think. And that was really encouraged at Waterloo. It was great. I mean, it has a reputation of being really biomechanics driven, but we are expected to think differently as well. So my thesis there, because I also knew that I wanted to go to chiropractic college at the time, was on like spine manipulation and the neurophysiological changes. And one thing that happened there that was lucky, I was exposed to two chiropractors. And so people say, oh, chiropractic, you know, it's the bone out of place and it's that motion palpation is everything and you're correcting a problem. I was exposed to two guys who were chiros and they came back at 40 to do their PhD. And they told me, don't go to chiropractic college. It's you don't need to.
Right.
And all that they did in their PhDs was to challenge everything about manual therapy that most people were learning. So this was Dave Bresnik and Kim Ross.
Yeah. This is only a third of the way through your studying prior to your clinical work.
So yeah, no,
tell me where that then went, because you did end up going to chiropractic college.
I did go. And what I think what would happen, so I like the biopsychosocial model, and some people start out very biomechanical, and people often think I did, and I had to make this big leap to go to the psychosocial. I didn't have to. I was actually exposed to that idea really young. Like, I used to read John Sarno when I was 20, and I was at an occupation like biomechanics at Waterloo, we were talking about psychosocial variables, that they were a big predictor of occupational injuries. And then these chiros influenced me, and they inoculated me against a lot of the manual therapy truisms that don't have a lot of support, like motion palpation and being directionally specific with your manipulation. So when I went to chiropractic college, I was like, I had a bee stuck in my bonnet the whole time, and I was such a jerk, and I challenged everything, and I would write diatribes about the bastardization of philosophy. I was not popular with anyone. But it was wonderful, because when I was there, I had a research program, and they funded me to start doing research while being a student at the same time. So it was a really weird situation, and I was teaching in the graduate studies department, but at the same time I was supposed to be learning. And I think I was the only faculty member to ever be on academic probation. Because,
wow.
Well, I was failing microbiology, and my boss was like, he's like, come on, if you're going to be on faculty here, maybe you should pass microbiology. And I was like, why the hell does any chiropractor have to know about microbiology? I don't care about bugs. I care about joints and muscles and pain.
For sure. And so then qualifying as a chiro.
I was going to have a chiro, and then I practiced and research part-time for 4 years in Kingston. And then I said I wanted to do something else, and I was thinking about getting a PhD, and I didn't have the acumen to get a really good scholarship that I would have needed to fund my babies and my wife. So I said, forget it, I'm going to go back to school for physiotherapy. You know, I wanted to try something different, and I wanted to open a lot of different doors in Canada. So I went back to school for physiotherapy in 2008 to 2010. And that was shocking. I swear, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, in some ways you've described it to me off microphone as being a weirdly backward step with the thinking. It was somewhat behind times.
It was. I mean, the teaching was great and the people there were fantastic. It was a 2-year program, but it was very condensed, and you thought, wow, they just want you to know everything that you need to know. And so it was good in that way. Chiro College is like memorizing the subway map of London. You're like, why the hell do I need to know this stuff? Yeah. But this was like, you need to know this. But when it came to manual therapy, you know, they were still doing motion palpation and PIVMs and PAMs, and they thought that that was valid, and they thought you could be directionally specific with manipulation, and they used words like locking down from the top and locking up from the bottom to get L2 on L3. And it was so shocking, because at chiropractic college, because of these two people I worked with, they said, you can't be specific if you're going to crack a back. You just do it. You know, it's probably a neurophysiological mechanism. You can't be specific in motion palpating and determining what segment is stuck or fixated. And then you go to physio and they're teaching. They're great teachers, but they're going through their credentialing process and they're saying these things that, is to me, was 30 years behind in chiropractic. And it's still, I'd say, quite dominant in the Canadian system.
Absolutely, and worldwide, I would say.
Really? Okay.
Others. So, no, I can see that resonating throughout different countries. So, not meaning to give a spoiler, but we're going to chat today about some biomechanical myths and misconceptions when it comes to their relationship with pain, something that we've just done on your course today. A basic defense I hear about a variety of intervention styles is, if it works, why are we bothered how it works? So if we corrected a biomechanical variable, symptoms improved, the patient's happy, why would we be so mindful as to why things work? What's your sort of stance on that?
So to some extent, I'm comfortable with people doing that if they're not providing an explanation that can lead to chronicity. So you can give a false explanation that might help you out in the short term, but it might create a sense of fragility, like saying, okay, this joint is out of alignment. I don't want to pick on that. I'm going to fix it for you. And then people will buy into that and feel better in the short term. The problem is when you keep going on and they are actually not getting better in the long term, and every problem that they have, they relate back to this, these biomechanical flaws, and that they have no control over changing themselves, and then they get reliant on care. But when it comes to the nitty-gritty, you know, if you're changing someone's posture because they're sensitized and you change something like a habit of movement and they feel better, that's okay. You know, I can't say why is that posture better, you know, or what the actual mechanism of changing nociception, or if it's a top down. We don't always have to know that. I'm comfortable working with that ambiguity and that vagueness, as long as I'm doing that in a manner that still instills a sense of like strength and control in the patient.
So the concept of that's wrong, let's do something right, that's where it doesn't sit so well with you.
That's, yes.
So when it comes to biomechanical variables or fixing people, it's the delivery of that message that's important.
Yes, and that it's false and that it may lead to a future problem. Like, you deal with these athletes and they come in and they tell you they have an upslip and a downslip and a torsion and one leg shorter, and they have all this litany of problems going on. It's just shocking how fragile they view themselves. So it's those type of explanations, and their rib is shifted or something like that, that we hear. This old antiquated ideas of things going out of alignment, and we're the ones that fix and correct them. And I think that creates, it ignores the robustness and beauty of the system to be strong and adapt. And our job is just to facilitate that in people, make them believe that they're as strong as we think they are, is always my goal.
Okay. So when you tell me about your history, and especially when it comes to the research work that you were doing, with regards to when you were working with the chiropractors, I always mispronounce his name, someone on Ross.
Dave Bresnik and Kim Ross.
That's right. So yeah. Tell me a little bit about what they did, because this is back in 2002. They did something that should have blown the lid off a lot of things that we still see as common practice now.
It's honestly one of my favorite research papers, and I think that it's huge for manual therapy. So they published a paper saying that the skin, you know, fascia interface is frictionless. I mean, if you do this at home, you know, take your finger and put it on your chin on the front and just slide that skin around. You know, you can't open your mouth by getting any friction on your jaw, and you can't translate it. You can translate it when the skin slack comes up because you're pulling some sort of skin a little bit, but you can't actually move that bone downward. So the idea, if you're thrusting through the thoracic spine, that it has to be in that 45-degree angle, that's just silly. The only effective force is that which goes perpendicular to that. And that's been studied by, they proved that, with that it's as frictionless. And a follow-up study by Pearl showed that all the accelerations were only in the plane, the force direction that was frictionless again. So in terms of motion palpation, in terms of finding a rib that's twisted or tilted, or a thoracic segment that's laterally shifted or rotated, you can't change that with a thrust. You can't bias it by any direction of force, because the force just goes down. In terms of manual therapy, if you do ART, you can't grab a muscle and tension it and make it longer, because it's frictionless. You can't pull it. I always give the example of, take your biceps, put your fingers there, and try to pull up that bicep. I'm going to shorten it by like walking your fingers up. You just can't grab it. You can't tension a muscle because of that friction, that frictionless interface. You can bowstring it, that's different.
Okay. And so when I like to put this paper under the noses of some, shall we say, devout manual therapists at times, and they'll often like to say about the fact that that's why you would take up the slack prior to a mobilization at a certain angle, a rotational preference or a manipulation. So that paper, if it's scrutinized, that accounts for that.
Yes, they did. So they knew that argument come, and they took up the slack, and then it didn't matter. And if you think of taking up the slack, so where does that go? It means that slack is attached to something. That skin isn't attached to the bone. It's attached, I don't know, down to the bottom of your foot. So maybe thoracic manipulation tugs up your calcaneus from the underside of your hip. Like, it just doesn't work that way. You can't pull it up.
And really, that is a good example of how some of the concepts the things that you promote can sometimes disgruntle people.
So yeah.
Would it be fair for me to say, why does a lot of what you say upset people? It does seem to rub people up in certain ways.
Yeah, I think it's the idea that this is the problem with physio and chiropractic and osteopathy. There's really smart people in there. Right. And it's hard to get in, and you work really hard. And I think there's a desire to do something that's complex. And we don't always want to do things that are simple because it seems like our interventions are too simple. So if I just say to someone, you're going to manipulate, all you have to do to manipulate the back is just have the force directed straight down, right? That's almost too simple. So someone would rather do something quite complicated because they've developed and they've invested this time and these skills, and they don't want it to be any monkey can just crack a back. And so I think that's part of the problem. And then I would also say is that people get good results with this complexity, and it fits. It fits their program of motion palpating and finding a flaw and then selling the solution to that flaw. And all of those things, they work for people to get out of pain sometimes. And so it's, you know, if you just simplify and say, well, what else am I going to do? Am I just supposed to lay them down and push on it and not have any skill? Like, that's a bit threatening. And then it makes you sort of say all this time spent was a bit worthless. So I think that's the pushback that I've seen, and it's been more than 15 years now.
And that's an example in manual therapy that you're certainly far from a lone voice in that sense, but you are a big proponent of a change in thinking of biomechanical processes, which is where people ended up landing when they moved away from structural orthopedic thinking. Okay, so we've got a real place in this. It's more to do with how people move.
Yeah.
And they've then ended up there, with or without manual therapy. Let's just think as exercise-based interventions then. How have you managed to upset people there?
Yeah. that started a long time ago too. So that all falls back into, if we look at the idea, we look at people move, and there's this assumption that there's a right or a better way to move. And we're the experts in movement, and we identify flaws. And our job is to correct those flaws, or the corollary of movement, if it's static, would be posture. And the corollary of posture when it's dynamic is form. And we want to be the experts in that. And that's what we change and try to correct. The problem is the research isn't that robust. And we don't always have to change posture or form to get someone out of pain. And then we have this amazing ability to move differently and adapt to movements. And so I think that, again, would upset people, because then we lose a bit of our sort of intellectual ownership of movement. If we say it's a lot simpler, that you don't have to correct the scapular position all the time or in a lot of situations, you don't have to correct spine posture. There's almost like there's nothing for you to do. You know, and then we can lose that control over that expertise, so to speak.
Okay. Yeah. And of course, and we'll come to a few examples of that, because you're not stripping back expertise to suggest we can't do anything, and that is sometimes. No. But is that a misconception that gets thrown?
Oh, huge. Back? So my friend Todd Hargrove, he said, you're a movement nihilist, meaning I don't care. And then that leads to the idea that you don't care about biomechanics. And actually, I love biomechanics, and I keep getting drawn back into it. I just think it can be really simplified. So to give an example, yes, biomechanics matter. They matter a lot, just not often in how we think. And I can give lots of examples. The best one to me and the most contentious would be knee valgus, right? That is the flaw that everyone points out. You know, there's a lot of memes on the internet where someone has their knee collapsing in and we think it's the worst thing ever and they're going to be prone to knee pain. And that's one where biomechanics might matter under certain conditions. I'm totally comfortable with the great Hewitt and Myers research when under high loads and under certain conditions, a big knee valgus with massive, you know, that big knee abduction moment where that foot is going out and the knee is going in under certain conditions, and in females especially, when during a drop landing, that seems to be a risk. But that high load situation doesn't necessarily translate over to you just walking down the road or just bending over to pick something off the ground. So I think we extrapolate from these situations that we have research on and put it across the board.
So do we extrapolate too widely because of complacency? Because we don't want to, we just want to latch on to that and distribute it as widely as possible?
Yeah, I think we also do it because there's a little bit of research showing that it translates to other other injuries too, like patellofemoral pain syndrome. And if you look at that, if I'm critical, there's certainly one prospective study, Norin, that shows that it's linked. You know, if you have 3 to 4 degrees more of hip adduction, you're more likely to get it. The problem with all those papers is what I'm interested in is there would be a lot of people in that uninjured group running for 2 years with huge hip adduction. You know, without a doubt, they would be more than 4 degrees than the average. And I'm interested in knowing if we just automatically say hip adduction is bad, and then we try to correct it in everyone, and if we don't ask the question, why can all these people run with increased hip adduction? You know, what does that mean? What are we missing out on? Like, if can we, and this is, I'm part of the problem because I'm not doing research anymore, and I feel a bit guilty. It's easier for me, if you're going to critique me, that's the way to critique me, is that I should be doing something about this. But I still want to ask, like, why do those people not get injured? Why do the people in the ACL studies who probably, because if you look at the Myers and Hewitt study, there's 8 people injured out of 200. I'm sure that there was a group of people with more knee abduction and they didn't get injured. Why didn't they get injured? What's going on there? What can we do to train and what can we intervene there? What are there psychosocial factors? I'm sure there are. Are there other biomechanical factors? Is there strength? Is there something mitigating the risk associated with falling into hip adduction? I want to know that stuff. And then going back to the PFPS, sorry, I don't think it's ever necessary to change hip adduction to get someone out of pain, specifically a runner. So yes, there are studies when you try to change hip abduction, people get out of pain. But there's a number of studies when you just train them and do other things to desensitize their running and build them back up and strengthen their hips and strengthen their knees, and they have patellofemoral pain syndrome, they get better and hip adduction doesn't have to change at all. So if changing hip abduction is not necessary to get out of pain, then how important is it? It's sufficient sometimes, but not necessary.
So again, the reason why that upsets people particularly is because it is suggesting that there's, well, excuse the metaphor, more than one way to skin a cat.
Yeah.
To the point where there might be hundreds. And that, is it because people invest so highly in that one variable? Or it's an attractive concept?
I think it's an attractive concept. And again, I think if you make it simpler, people might not like that. And I think we should make it simpler. And I should start like a support group for people that want to say, it can be really simple sometimes. The biomechanics can be simple. It's okay to be simple. It's okay to say, you know what? Let's just strengthen this joint and the joint above it. And sometimes that's enough to help people out. You know, rather than doing fancy exercises and focusing on it and sucking in your stomach and contracting your glutes and doing all of these things that are just kind of interesting but probably not necessary.
So there's bigger fish to fry a lot of the time, yeah?
Yeah, my argument to make the biomechanics simpler is because there are a lot of complex variables in people with pain or persistent pain, even in athletic populations. And if we just focus so strongly on the biomechanics, we might lose our skills in addressing sort of the psychosocial variables.
One of the things that I'm going to quote you on is that you'd said that it's not the pain science literature that questions biomechanics.
Yeah.
It's the biomechanics literature that questions biomechanics. I'm all right to quote you on that.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you expand on that a little bit more for the listeners that weren't on your course today?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is what I've seen since 98. It's confusing. Like, if we say that's a faulty knee pattern when the knee internally rotates and the hip adducts, and that's because the foot will pronate and they'll drive up this intersegmental dysfunction. Well, you go look at the 3 prospective studies and hip adduction, there's a good example. There's that prospective study. I always want to say if it's Bowling or Bogla, I'm not sure. It's the JUMP ACL study from 2009. They didn't find adduction at all, hip adduction, to be a variable. So we'll say it's important in one study, but then there's another prospective study where it's not important at all. And so what does that tell me? They showed that hip internal rotation was a factor. Only if you took the 10th percentile of having lots of hip internal rotation and the 90th percentile, you know, and by using those extremes, they probably had really low numbers at those values and maybe a couple injuries would have skewed it. Or you take Norin's study, and I'm pretty sure that hip internal rotation, certainly calcaneal eversion, wasn't a factor. And those are things that we often say. And then you go look at the whole idea of this regional interdependency, that calcaneal eversion will drive up tibial internal rotation. It doesn't. That linkage, that's been really strongly studied. I have a 3D gait kinematic system where I'm lucky enough to measure all those variables in all three planes. I never see this relationship of more calcaneal eversion and increase. I often see increased calcaneal eversion and the opposite of tibial internal rotation and less, and I'll see hip external rotation during running. And so it's so frustrating.
I'm still playing around with the same question of why you upset people, just because it's sort of an amusing question.
It's so confusing.
But essentially, yeah, it's confusing, and you're open to the fact that it confuses you, and you're trying to make sense of it. But as part of that, is that one of the things that's intimidating about this stance? Is the fact that you're a clinician that is trying to apply certain variables within the parameters available to you and finding that it just doesn't hold water in a clinical setting? Is that what's intimidating in a way?
It might be, but I think the ultimate conclusion is that we can make it simpler. And I think there's a resistance to saying that it can be really simple. So if someone has increased hip adduction, we have those same studies that look at that. What do? Some of them will strengthen the hips, which is great, and we can argue to do that because it has performance benefits, and they'll strengthen the quads, and they'll do it all over the place and do different ways of doing it. Those people get better, and they don't have changes in their hip adduction, and they're running fine, and you change their programming too. So I think just saying that it's that simple. However, there's always some doubt in here, and I don't have a problem with that. I know that you can change someone's hip adduction when they're running, make them think of running that you have a ball between your knees or you point your kneecaps up. Rich Willey does excellent research on internal and external cueing of how to change these things, and he's getting people better with changing running patterns. And I do that too. But then you can look at J.F. Esculier's papers where he's not showing that there's any increased hip adduction with running injuries. And he's just showing if you increase your cadence or if you do a better return to run program, that's enough to get people better. Just something as simple as increasing your cadence often changes all the biomechanics up the chain. Certainly changes loading, but it often changes all these other variables too. So again, another simple intervention. But we often don't like simple.
Fantastic. Right. So we will. I'm gonna drag you back into the lower limb a little later on. But let's talk about a body part in which biomechanical variables are generally recognized, particularly by evidence-informed clinicians, as less relevant. So let's go lumbar spine. What misconceptions are most prevalent in that region? And do you have any particular examples of those?
So I think I wrote a paper where I said that the spine was inherently unstable. This was a common theme from Panjabi's work, where if you took away all the muscles, the spine would buckle under 10 kilograms. And we always said that. So we said how important the muscles were. Yes, but the thing was, it doesn't really take a lot of force to stabilize the spine. I mean, with 32 kilograms on your back, an old paper from Cholowicki, I'm pretty sure, and McGill, it's like 4% of maximum contraction. And so the idea, and so yeah, if you're lifting a car with your grandmother underneath it, I just changed that story. Usually it's the grandmother lifting the car to save the child. I'm lifting a car with my grandmother underneath it because I'm robust. So yeah, maybe massive amounts of spinal bracing is appropriate in those situations. That's a high load situation and spine stability is pretty important there. But under low load conditions, why would we transfer what we need under high load to just everyday life? Like if you think you have to activate your core and brace your stomach before picking something up that's light or getting in and out of a chair or sitting straight, like that makes no sense. You're just running with biomechanics and applying it to situations that aren't relevant.
The thing that gets faced with that is that people are saying, oh, well, we no longer talk about normal, we talk about optimal. Isn't that just semantics? People just changing their excuses?
Well, they're wrong, because it's not, sorry, it's probably not optimal. Like, I'd like to hear why you should have to have ab activity. It's so fun, it's such an under-research area, abdominal ab activity. They think you need a lot of ab activity when you do a squat. There's not a lot of research on that. We did some pilot studies, people doing clean and jerk and heavy squat with 2x body weight, And I was like, what the hell? Why is, because my thesis was you could train the abs. This is what I used to publish in, very middling research on what the abs did during every exercise on a Swiss ball, on a wobble board, all of those things. And the anterior abs were hardly turning on at all. It was shocking during the clean and jerk. So I was totally wrong. I thought you can get a great ab workout doing heavy squats. And you can. And there's one guy's master's science thesis from like 77 that I found. And it was like, you know, 4 to 8% again of ab activity during a heavy squat. So some, if there's any young student out there, you don't have to be young, or if you own an EMG equipment, I'd love to see someone just do that. Do 20 subjects, heavy, heavy squats, and see what the abs do. There's the Escamilla paper with deadlifts, but I think that's different. He showed like high 50% activity in the external obliques and stuff like that. But I don't, but other than that, just sitting down, it doesn't take anything. Doing a squat takes nothing.
Right.
You don't really need the big demand there.
Okay. And so the concept of core stability we explored in a podcast recently. Any yeah. other particular spinal misconceptions with regards to biomechanics? Movements of lifting, for example, or
so there's an example of when biomechanics matters. Like I love Stu McGill's research. I think he's just fantastic, his career. And we debate and argue about stuff. He had once told me, I once said to him, like, I think I was, because he would only take two students a year. I was like, you know, maybe I was fishing for a compliment. I didn't get it. But I was like, I think I was probably your dumbest master's student ever. And he just said, probably, you know, but you had a... but he didn't disavow him at all. It was like, but, you know, you talked a lot. Or something. He asked some okay questions. He's such a good guy. Anyways, I love it. His work when it comes to heavy loading, we can't question it. That's where biomechanics might be important. So if you're lifting up something really heavy, then we can respect and you're going to fully flex your spine. We can say that the shear values are going to increase and the compression values are going to increase. And that's consistent across other models of the spine, like Shirazi et al. Although the other day I was told that Jap Van Dien didn't show that. I don't know. But that there's an idea where you're actually getting close to tissue tolerance. You know, maybe that's important. Like if you jump off a roof, I'm not going to land on one foot and stick it. You know, so there's an optimal way to do that. So maybe heavy loading, I'm cool with that. And adaptation has its limits there.
Okay, but translating that to picking up something from the
picking
floor,
it up, walking, something like. This idea that our muscle, that our joints are sloshing around and need the stability. It's so weird. Like movement is good everywhere else. Why do we need to restrict a little bit of translation? I don't even know what we're restricting. That things pop out. Like, so, yeah,
tell me about
it.
Let's talk about that as a case study that you brought up today in the course. In that, let's say a fairly contemporary way in which biomechanics has crept into recent things. It's not a new concept, but it's a very popular one at the moment. Where you described a patient that came into your clinic, this mentioning that a rib shift needed correcting specifically. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was more, I mean, this was a pretty elite half Ironman triathlete, and she just was afraid to squat and was afraid to bend over, and she would talk about her spine being unstable and her hips unstable, and the only way she would do a bodyweight squat was to take her hand and push her, because someone told her that her rib had shifted out of position and it always needed correcting. So she had this sense of fragility. And it was the contrast between her performance of successfully competing in half Ironmans and being flexed over your bike for, what are they on there? At least 3 hours, I'm pretty sure, in the half iron, and running for an hour and a half or less and swimming that far with huge loading through the spine. And she can't do a bodyweight squat without shifting her rib. You know, that was one of those, like, oh my goodness, like what has, and this is therapist driven or maybe runner's world driven, that she felt that she needed correcting and that she was inherently fragile and inherently unstable. And it was really shocking. And so we spent 2 hours. She came to me because she thought she was getting a biomechanics assessment. That was the funny thing, because I write for Triathlon Canada. And they always don't let me write my psychosocial stuff.
I just imagine her disappointment.
No. I warned her first, and I was willing not to charge her and let her go home, but she let me. So we just worked for 2 hours. I would do fake rib translations and try to do the opposite and pull her skin. And my goal was to confront her with the idea that she was strong and robust and that I could change her pain by doing the opposite of a rib shift, just doing some neuromodulatory stuff with my hands and tugging on the skin or trying to shove her rib the other way, even though I don't think we're really doing that much translation. I don't see how it goes out. And that confrontation, which probably wouldn't work with everybody.
No.
And so that's scary and sometimes it fail a lot. It worked with her, right? Like she was able to squat pain-free and do those things. And then she didn't come back because I wanted to follow up in a week. And I was like, Christ, I lost her. You know, oh no. But I emailed her 3 weeks later and she said she was just fine. So either she placated me and lied to me.
Yeah, so you emailed her... Out of interest, or
just fine, still training. You know, it's one of the things where she felt better training. So how can you feel better swimming and training and think that your ribs out of alignment? And the thing, I don't want to knock like the rib theories and the people that promote that. Like I don't doubt that they get massive clinical success. That's one thing. Every time we criticize this stuff, I'm never criticizing clinical success. Because you can't. I'm sure that like that's a powerful image when you say your rib's out of position and then you do something to correct it or whatever and the patient feels great. I can see why people get better. I think that's what all of the good treatments, not what they say is right, but what they do of getting the patient to buy in and giving that patient a little bit sense of hope that you can change and their pain is malleable. Like, that's what I think those things, even though I think their biomechanical reasoning is flawed. And my concern is some of them, we set them up for fragility that they need to be fixed.
So, we prime that problem.
Yeah. Don't put words in my mouth. That's the third, that one. That was a good one. No, I was right. Thank you.
So, with that then, it's important for us to realize that we're not just trying to pick holes in this with data. We're picking holes with this with basic feasibility concepts. In terms of the biomechanics being...
Biological plausibility. We can always go back. Is that plausible that thing is unstable? And why would something moving around a little bit cause nociception and pain? And that just doesn't make sense. Or why would a joint or a muscle like the TVA that's 50 milliseconds delayed, you know, why would that cause a problem in the periphery? He does, because no one ever said, to Paul Hodge's defense, like he's amazing too. He's an amazing researcher. He never said it was shut off. He just said it was delayed a little bit, you know. And I think I don't want to put words in his mouth either, but I think he's saying that's just it's like the victim of the corruption in the brain and the brain body map and how the control is. It's just sort of something. And Anne Mannion's research is great now, saying, who cares about it? You get them better, and it doesn't matter if they're delayed. It has no correlation to clinical success.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean sucking in your stomach isn't helpful. Sometimes when you do it, what are you doing? What are you doing when you sit, lie on your stomach, think about that body part, pull in your stomach? It's incredibly mindful. So there's going to be a group of people that are just paying attention to their stomach and their back, and that's probably helpful. You know, because they're maybe doing something at the brain level or they're maybe creating a little confidence down there. So it could even have a specific effect. It's just not the effect that we think it has anything to do with stability.
Yeah. And that's the thing that comes back
on
to that mechanism of effect.
I don't know.
But when it comes to, we're going to go on a bit of a journey now into what we've talked about misconceptions, etc., and the thoughts in which what you maybe don't like. We're going to get towards what we talked about the majority today, which was to offer a reasonable alternative. But symptom modification is something that we've kind of touched on, and I know we did today in the course. And it's a popular technique when treating sort of subacromial pain. Jeremy Lewis's work, very popular. Pete O'Sullivan's cognitive functional therapy is very symptom modification.
I didn't know he did
driven.
That.
But it's less. It seems less common in the lower limb. So,
yeah.
is it fair for me to say the lower limb is where traditional biomechanical paradigms thrive, And if so, why might that be? And feel free to say no, it's not.
I think they still thrive in the upper limb, especially when we look at the, I mean, we have the knee summit, the patellofemoral summit, if they're calling that, or the retreat, and we have the scapular summit. So I think it's just thriving as much over there.
Cool.
But I think you're totally right that in the lower limb, to get symptom modification, it's much harder. I try to do symptom modification with everyone, and I feel like it's more drawn out because if someone's running, it's like their pain comes on at 3K. So I can't change it immediately, but I can do something to get them to 3.5 and to 4K. So we still do it, but it's over a longer term scale.
Less immediate, less of a particular buy-in.
Unless it's that knee pain with a squat, you know, you can. It's fun to change that. You can change the stress to the hip. You can push their hips out. What's really fun, sometimes you cave their knee into valgus and they squat with less pain. And you confront them with the idea that their knee is like going way over and it's scouring around and it's over their toe and it's inwards. And it kind of freaks them out. So they've been told that they can't do it. And you expose them to something that they think they're not allowed to do and it doesn't hurt. It's really amazing, and that helps as well. So I do lots of like flaw training, meaning do the thing you think you're not supposed to do and train that ability to tolerate it. Because guaranteed you're doing it in a sport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. In a sporting context, in a work context, in a life context, variation is normal.
Yeah. I mean,
we don't move the same as we did even an hour earlier.
No. That knee goes over the toe when you walk up and downstairs. You can't get away from that. If you're a goalie in hockey in Canada, what is the butterfly position? I don't know if everyone knows, but your thighs are together and your feet are abducted. So you have knee abduction. You have a massive valgus and you're putting huge force through there, and that's required to play the position. That's something they need. And then they push off and load in that and go back and forth. I don't know if you've ever seen it. That's what you do.
I have, yeah. Like, I've never thought of it that way, but I know what you mean in there.
It's like, imagine you're wearing a skirt for the first time. You don't want anyone to see up your dress, and you got to squat down. You squeeze your legs together, and your feet are splayed.
Yeah, you're looking at me weird now. You're just thinking of me in a skirt, aren't you?
I thought about it earlier. It was easy to just access that memory.
Okay.
Okay.
Let's move on. There's certain things in the lower limb in which you clearly deem to be, to some degree, relevant, but small fry. And the clinical, I know the measurability is not the right word, but the validity of actually how we test those things is the biggest problem you might have with them. So what's happened most recently that seems to have frustrated you?
I mean, the big one is, you know, I can measure calcaneal eversion dynamically as people are running, and there is a great research paper by Brad Neal and Chris Barton and their research group, which is great. Like, I would never criticize their methodology, and they made a conclusion that an increased foot drop or foot posture, as measured by, I think, navicular drop and another measure of foot posture, was predictive of future medial tibial stress syndrome. And I'm going to get the words wrong, that it was a strong effect, but even though it was small, and also a more medium effect at the knee. And my whole thing was that, okay, well, that's interesting, like statistically, but when we looked at the data, which I had trouble saying, why do I care about this clinically? Because I wouldn't know what the cutoff was to measure it, like what amount is, and this isn't their fault. This is just, take a good research paper, you're like, well, what the hell do I do this?
This is a systematic review, right?
Yeah, so they're not designing the research, and it's not up to them to give clinical advice. So you take a paper like that, and someone will say, okay, so there's a statistical difference between someone who gets injured and their foot posture. But then when you look at all of the papers that have it, like one group might have a navicular drop of 8.9 millimeters, and then the injured group has, 9.3 millimeters. Another group would be 6.2 millimeters, and then would go up to 6.7 millimeters. Other would be 11. So there's this massive variability. So I can never say what normal is. So if I'm measuring in the clinic, where is the risk factor where it's enough. And then if you looked at the average difference, it was less than a millimeter. Like less than a millimeter of foot drop between the two injured groups across those papers. And then I say, well, I don't see why I care about that. So then a clinician would say, well, you care. And I wrote a blog on this, which is, I know, not even on the levels of evidence. But I said, well, maybe it's a factor if there's all of these other variables going on. But then I'm really just searching. I'm just reaching for straws there. So I'd say, well, maybe a little bit of foot posture coupled with massive amounts of pronation velocity, and then they stayed pronated for a long time. Maybe that's a factor, and then we just can't tease that out of the research. But am I really just trying to find a variable there?
Is that how your brain works then? You'd quite like to shoehorn biomechanics into your thinking because that's your history. So you try and
to
put
make
it in
it.
There, and then you really struggle with it clinically.
Yeah, I try to make it relevant. And then I would take something like that and I would say, okay, so maybe it's relevant because I can't discount it because I know people that would address it. And then I would say, okay, it'd be very hard to change. This is in an uninjured population. Maybe if someone had this, well, I would say, well, how do we teach them to tolerate those movements? And I would want to strengthen them and strengthen it into pronation and popping back out of pronation and do a lot of dynamic work where you're training those muscles to tolerate that. So I feel like I'm covering all my bases here if I'm wrong about the relevance of that kinematic variable.
So let's say we're able to measure it very reliably.
Yeah.
And say that was incredibly robust evidence behind that review. You're feeling like your direction you would take that was, we've identified that risk, and therefore we're going to train tolerance rather than adjust that variable, trying to actually change it,
and
normalize it.
And then the worst part here is I would train it in everybody because none of that research helps me flag who is in need of the intervention. And so as long as I can justify an intervention for two reasons, maybe injury prevention, but you can also say training those movements is good because it can lead to performance enhancement, because all that is just jump training and strength training. And say for a runner, that's a good thing. They should be doing it as well. So that's the thing. We argue about these things, and really, we're not that far apart because it doesn't really matter what we do in the end. But again, it comes back to making it really simple. Let's just train that joint to get that joint to do everything that it can.
And so the interesting thing about that research is that it is not therefore the flaw of that review.
No, they just presented the data.
But then on presentation of the data, when it is discussed in a clinical application sense, is that where it starts to get frustrating? Because I certainly, having read that paper, didn't then go to the depths of scrutinizing the statistical analysis of each of the individual papers that had formed that conclusion.
I just looked at the numbers. I just had questions about the numbers. I said, it's less than a millimeter, and there's a massive variability there. So if I take those papers at face value, it still doesn't tell me anything about what to do.
So the discussion and conclusion, whether it was certainly far from intentional, but it can be misleading on a clinical level?
If I remember correctly, I think their discussion, like they were very open and said, you know, they mentioned that it didn't, what was good, they mentioned that it didn't have any effect on all the other things. So they went out of their way to do that. That was good. I think they did write that this is something that can be clinically relevant. And I think that's their clinical opinion. And my clinical opinion would be, I don't know how that's clinically relevant because I don't see how to use it. That's the thing. Unless you went to all of these other modifiers, and I don't know where the other modifiers are on that. So I think they just said it's clinically relevant. I say, well, it's statistically significant, but is it clinically relevant? And that's good. You know, we're supposed to disagree on stuff, though, all those things. And I just don't see how it's clinically relevant because I can't figure it out.
No, I get that. That's cool. So as far as let's do a made-up case study in that I'm going to pick a biomechanical variable everyone's sort of comfortable with in that I'm assessing someone that's in front of us both. And they do a single leg squat and they drop into what is considered a fairly typical knee valgus in which there might be some hip adduction.
Hip adduction.
Let's say it's coupled with therefore some pronation at the foot, and this is on a single leg squat in a clinical setting, and that hurts. And to a lesser extent, it hurts less, but it's still a variable even on a two leg squat. So there's still that propensity, but it's more pronounced in a single leg squat. So we're in that, and then we encounter that daily. I'm sure you do. And this is a runner. Okay, so tell me a little bit about what a typical way in which that would be treated. If I'm not going to tar all physios with one brush or all therapists with one brush, but typically it'd be like, let's improve that movement, or at least try and draw towards a normalized pattern as far as a textbook, what we expect the leg should do. So if that's not the way we're going to go, I think it's fair to say from our chat so far, tell me a little bit about how you
approach
that.
But what the alternative is.
Yeah.
Well, it's obviously you have to activate the VMO.
Oh, there's the answer. We can end it
with
now.
With needles and like deep fascial rubbing to activate, and then I rub their TMJ. And after I do that, so how I would approach that, okay, it's like any other movement that's sensitized. And I view a sensitized movement as a habit or a movement that gets coupled with pain. It could be flexion in the spine, a certain arm lift. Okay, I don't consider them flaws. I consider them just habits, and I consider them certain ways that people choose to move. They're problematic because they hurt. Okay, and so that movement profile is coupled with pain. So my job initially, let's break up that couple. You know, so get them moving differently. So this is an example where biomechanics matter.
And you're not specifically meaning centrally there. You're not saying centrally neurologically. You're meaning just generally.
There could be nociception. It could be down. It could be top up. I have no idea where the brain and where the nociception interrelate. But if it hurts, that's not cool. And so if we can change how they move, pushing the knees out, sometimes you cave even more in. That's really neat. And start loading up that tissue again, because we know if you load tissue, it's going to adapt. It's such a little simple thing to do. So if we change that movement to start getting them moving again without pain, we let them desensitize, and then we get them running again because that's meaningful to them. Yeah, so the most important thing is we know that that movement is painful. And like any movement that's painful, we just want to stop them doing it for a little bit to desensitize it. And so the argument would be, well, you're correcting the flaw. I'm like, no, I'm just not having them do it for a little while. And my goal, I think, in the future is that they can do that movement and it's not going to hurt again. So I don't have to correct a flaw. I only do it transiently to get them out of pain for a while. But at the same time, I also look at that joint. I'm like, why do they always want to cave in? Like a good joint, this is just a philosophy of mine, or any good movement, you should be able to have lots of options on how to move. So I would correct their movement, although I don't like that word. I would just teach them other ways to move so that they can do a single leg squat with their knee going in, but they can also do it with their knee going outwards, or going straight up and down, or going forward and translating back. So if I think of just this comprehensive capacity, that joint should be able to do everything that we want it to do.
So instead of doing it traditionally well, you would introduce,
I wouldn't even call it well,
lots of different ways,
yes,
in which, yeah.
Yeah,
you wouldn't therefore get them to think you're doing that wrong,
tell them
or that's
it's a
not
flaw.
Helpful. Or
no, I can't say it's... The only reason it's a bad movement is because it hurts. Because we know lots of people have like hip adduction, like Priska Jepdu. She runs like that. Everything caves in. And she runs fine and she's in no pain.
And that's a Kenyan
marathon runner. Lots of people flex their spine and it doesn't hurt. We transiently change the movement pattern to desensitize them, and then they go back and they can tolerate that movement in the future. Instead of instilling the idea, oh, I can't ever do that, when we know in normal sport and daily life, your knee has to cave in and you should be able to tolerate it. So rather than setting up to think that I can't do it, you just desensitize for a bit and then reload it and get them used to doing it again.
And that sits well both in terms of, so top down, we're saying we're uncoupling a neurotag with movement, but then also bottom up, we might be suggesting that the tissues are stressed in a different way and therefore are less sensitive. So it's and we don't necessarily we're not caring which of those things. It's going to be likely to be a mix of both.
Exactly, and then we can pragmatically look at the good work that says train the hips and train the knee, you know, and they both are helpful, so we'll do it all. But we don't have to say it's just because of mechanics and we're making people move better. or changing the quality of movement. Move well before you load or something. Like, I don't know how anyone can say that there's a right way to move. It's just not supported with,
and therefore,
with what we know.
Screening for it's not clearly doesn't sit well with
no, that. If I had to create a screen, which I can't imagine, you see me in 3 years' time peddling some cheesy screen, you can tie me up. My screen to me is just that comprehensive capacity screen. I don't know what movement flaws or what movement leads to a dysfunction or an injury. So if I can say, I want my athletes and patients to be able to do everything, my movement screen would test that. Like, how well you were doing a one-legged squat? Can you do it when your knee caves in? Can you do it when your knee goes out? Can you do it laying against the wall? Can you do it leaning? You know, we get to end range. Do you feel comfortable? Do you feel confident? So it's not easy, because it's not, it's the weird, like, what the hell are you doing? There's 25 to 100 different tests there, but you're just testing every joint in every different position that it might possibly get into, and you see how the patient feels.
So I really like the comprehensive capacity concepts there, but the argument against it would be that although you're trying to cast the net wide, which I completely buy,
yeah,
does that not just water down the strength and conditioning effect that could occur, in which if you chose, even if you just chose two or three of those different ways? So we're still on this single leg squat.
Yeah, so there'll be carryover. Like, we know that specificity isn't that specific. That's what's great about the body. It'll carry over to other ranges in that. And I think good strength coaches, they just do the fundamentals. So that's the argument against you do all these silly exercises where you're exploring all these different movements. I think they're just adjuncts to the basics.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what's great about the tendon research. You have patellar tendinopathy, you train that hard, right? I forget the details, but I think it's hack squats, regular squats, and leg extensions. You just train that patellar tendon. Like,
that's the Magnussen.
That's the, I can't say his name, Kajar, K-J-A-E-R, Magnussen work. Like the heavy resistance training, that is so fantastic. And that's Pete Malieris did a great systematic review on that. You know, you just train it and ask that tendon to adapt. And that stuff carries over.
Do what they can tolerate.
Yeah.
Load them as best they can.
Yeah, I don't think we load people enough. We treat our patients like they need these remedial exercises where, you know, sometimes we have to confront them with their strength and show them that they're strong. Or, you know, poke the bear, it hurts a little bit, and say, that pain you don't need. You that pain isn't telling you anything. You're just sensitized. As long as you're not too sensitized, we poke into that, and it's so fun. Sometimes someone has pain in their back with bending. You just do deadlifts. I sound like a meathead. You just get them, and if deadlifting is important to them, they do deadlifts. They're not too sensitized. They don't have a lot of other issues going on. You've kind of given them permission and the psychosocial support, you could say, and they load. And finally, the brain or the body says, okay, you've created enough of a stimulus for an adaptation. I'm going to adapt and it doesn't hurt.
And you've drawn a lot of parallels with the tendon research throughout the course today, as well as this chat. And you feel that that is a sensible way in which we can...
I think almost the tendon loading stuff is the way to look at persistent pain in some ways. You know, if it's really two stages of reactive and the other one being disrepair degenerative. So reactive is that super sensitive patient who's in persistent pain. The degenerative is that patient where it's not that sensitive, but they still had it for a long time. Those ones you really load up heavy and get them adapting, and you look at doing aerobic exercise, and if it's a tendon, you still look at all their psychosocial factors too. When it's reactive, you take it easy for a little bit. You let it settle down. You don't do anything that aggravates it. That, in the back, that would be an example of someone who's always doing the same movement and they're always keep aggravating their back because they've never given their back a break. And you just say, let's back off for a bit. You know, I don't have to blame your Achilles tendon on some hip dysfunction or a shift at L3. You just overloaded it and you haven't given it a break for 6 months because you've fallen into the same pattern where you're just pissing it off all the time and everything you do. Just back off and change how they move for a little bit.
Okay. Well, if I'm putting my devil's advocate hat on, which I know I wear a lot,
I don't mind.
You're flogging the adaptation model to death, some would say.
Some would say. And it's not really, though, because we're still changing and giving people a break. You know, and I'm still saying that there are some movements that I would avoid. The true, if you really believe in adaptation, you would say you can bend over and pick up a weight any way that you want, and you'll adapt. And sometimes I want to argue that, because you see people, that would be my next self-experiment. You just deadlift with a fully flexed spine slowly over time and progress into it with a graded exposure and see if I get injured. I mean, that's the adaptation model, but we don't totally. I still think biomechanics matters sometimes.
Mm.
But I do think that we incredibly adaptable.
But it's at the extremes of what you're saying is that biomechanics matter enough to make it a priority in those high load situations. Would be that with high velocity cutting or in lifting a car
or when there's acute tissue damage, we're going to unload it and give them a break and change how they move and have a crutch and
understanding
something.
The biomechanics in that sense helps us to offload.
Yeah, so if someone has a really sensitive spine because their disc herniated and there's a chemical onslaught and there's an inflammatory mediator and flexion really hurts that, so let's decrease that. But don't tell them you can never flex again. You know, give them a break for a little bit and let it settle down. That's when you teach spinal sparing, because that's biomechanically relevant. It's okay to go to use Stu McGill stuff there and teach a good hip hinge. Nothing wrong with that. Or someone who always flexes their back and always uses their spine, even though it hurts their spine and gives them discomfort. Those people, yeah, you... That's too much. You're not adapting to that. You're sensitizing it. You're always winding yourself up. Those, I mean, that's how sensitization occurs, when you keep giving that nociceptive input. They have never let their back get out of a flex position. So for them, they've failed to adapt to that.
Mm.
So then we'll scale them back and say, do these other strategies for a little bit. That's okay to say that.
So it's not forcing adaptation into the mix. It's just accounting for it.
It'd be like with tendons. Sometimes we overload them, and we'd say, "Well, just keep loading them; they'll eventually adapt." No, sometimes they failed to adapt. So let's back them off and
build it up.
Do something different. Build it up again.
So it's coupling neurological tolerance with mechanical transduction and the adaptation that can occur on a tissue level.
Yeah.
And never biasing one over the other there.
No, and then also recognizing that tissue tolerance is influenced by our psychosocial variables, not just pain tolerance.
Yeah.
You know, and I think coaches know that. They're doing a lot of things. Coaches are great psychosocial interveners.
Yeah.
You might not realize it, but they are. They work with their athletes and get the most out of their brains.
For sure.
They coax a lot out of their athletes when the athlete doesn't believe they can do something. I mean, that's a psychosocial variable, and they do something to challenge them with that. It's
sure.
The same.
So where can people find more about you? I know you've got a couple of booklets that you've put out there for free that I would highly recommend. So tell the listeners a little bit about that.
I just transferred all my websites over to just greglehman.ca, and the old bodymechanic.ca site now goes there. It's very rudimentary and it's not fully up to date, so give me a little bit on that. And that does have two booklets. And I want to put more free stuff on there, and I want to share more. I think that's really important to me. So check that out for that. There's the Pain Science Workbook, where I just give out to patients. And it's totally a bastardization of Explain Pain and other great researchers. You know, it's nothing original. I just think it's something that you can give to people, and they can use, and it might
help. And that's available as a free resource.
Oh, it's just a PDF. Yeah, it's free. And then the other one is like a treatment manual, which sort of outlays my the biomechanical approach, when biomechanics matters. That's in there, and loading and different parameters of different exercises you can do for different conditions or different states.
Cool, brilliant. And in regards to, you're active on Twitter and across Facebook.
Yeah, Twitter and Facebook, because I just got sucked into Twitter. But I don't want to argue. We're allowed to debate. That's the big thing with this, is like disagreeing with tons of respect, so we can always talk and disagree with each other. But I'll pull away if there's anything that's like snarky and not nice. And you can accuse me of that too. And then I'll modify my behavior if I'm ever being insulting, because that's no fun. That's just uncomfortable.
Yeah, so one of my early questions about the fact that you seem to upset people, that's certainly far from intentional, from having...
No, it's an old habit, and I probably did in the past. And I know I did it with Stu when I was really young. And I try not to, because it doesn't help. like, really, I want people to change their beliefs, but I also want to get challenged and maybe have my beliefs change. And if we put up our defenses, then it's not very successful. So I always get uncomfortable when things get uncomfortable. I mean, I just took Peter O'Sullivan's course, and I took Kieran O'Sullivan's course last year. I think that's really key. And I think Peter probably gets maligned for people thinking that he's all psychosocial, but he really reconceptualizes biomechanics as well. And that surprised me with his course. So I think that's excellent. All the explained pain stuff for anyone doing that. With Mike Stewart, I know you've worked with Mike before. Those same things, just different ways of explaining things to people to make them feel like they're robust. And I still think there's some value in some manual therapy courses. You know, and just my friends of mine teach the functional anatomy of palpation and functional range of release. You don't have to explain. I wouldn't explain it the way they do, but there's still tips and tricks in there that are useful. Even if you don't totally agree, I think there's still stuff to get from all these great clinicians. You know, just fitting into your framework. Oh, and Diane Jacobs. I like Diane's stuff from manual therapy. I've referenced her a few times, and she's very open to sharing with people.
Brilliant. So I
do really appreciate your time and sharing this with us, especially I know you're not in the country for so long, so I've been lucky to get you on the microphones.
Yeah, I'll be back, though.
Oh, I'm sure.
In June.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, that's something we should plug, really, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I forgot about that.
I suck.
Seasonal pros.
No, I'm back in June in London. And then yeah. Edinburgh the week before, or the during the week.
We'll definitely put the dates up for that and the links up to that. Like, okay. I'm sure you'll get some busy rooms. I can't believe we nearly forgot about that. So.
Yeah, and it's fun. If you ever come, you're allowed to like yell at me and challenge. That's the best stuff.
Yeah.
Ever when people do that. It's not random heckling.
I know. If you tolerated me today on your front row, so I'm sure that any listener that wants to come in.
No, that'd be fantastic.
Manage, wouldn't they? So, again, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
And there we have session 16. Many thanks to Greg for sparing the time to chat about his thoughts on where he feels the science directs us. I can highly recommend his course, and to be honest, I tend to prefer conferences these days, so do give the free course notes a look over when they're pushed out with our show notes newsletter. There's some absolute gold that has been trimmed from this episode, and so keep an eye out on our Facebook page, YouTube channel and Twitter feed for some exclusive soundbites that we'll be releasing soon. If you can't get enough of the sensible expert opinion that we're broadcasting monthly, and you can still tolerate my voice and waffly questions, then please head over to ifompedconference.org and register your interest in what is shaping up to be the event of the decade. We've recorded feature-length podcasts with all 7 keynote speakers, including Roger Kerry, Joel Bielski, Lorimer Moseley, and out soon, an extended edition with Dr. Jeremy Lewis. These are brought to you free by the IFOMP 2016 Organising Committee, and you have 2 key choices to make. You can listen, register and attend, or you can be left behind by the relentless progress of contemporary MSK practice. It's your call. Bye for now.